I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A lot of people agree downtown Kansas City is better looking and more fun now than it was 15 years ago, and a lot of that has to do with something called TIF, Tax Increment Financing. Today, we'll explore this program and learn where in our city it's happening. Developers love it, but skeptics say TIF takes dollars away from public schools and infrastructure. Then, we'll talk to the people who answer the phone when someone calls the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. They'll tell us what it's like to be on the other side of those challenging conversations and how they cope after a particularly difficult day. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Few economic instruments have seen as much use in Kansas City's development, or in recent years as much controversy, as TIFs, Tax Increment Financing Districts. If you love the Power and Light District, or the Freight House restaurant area there in the Crossroads, or the new IRS and H&R Block offices, you have TIF to thank for those. But many critics say that if you're unhappy with the condition of Kansas City public schools, or the lack of affordable housing in the city, you might also have TIF to thank for those. As efforts to limit or reduce the use of TIFs gain traction in the city and in the Missouri legislature, we're taking two shows these next couple of weeks to get our heads around the pros and cons of these financial incentives. Next week, we're going to hear more of the pro-TIF arguments, but joining us today to help us unpack the arguments against TIF is Terry Ward. He teaches public administration at Park University. He also sits on the city's TIF commission representing the North Kansas City School District. Terry, welcome to Up to Date.
Brian, it's great to be here.
So we need to start, I think, with the most basic question. If people don't know already, what is tax increment financing?
Tax increment financing is something that was started a number of years ago in California. Actually, it came to Missouri about 20 years ago. And the premise is that there is a desire to create incentives for businesses to either come to the city or to expand in the city. And the way that that happens is by offering tax incentives. Tax increment is dealing with new taxes that are created so that you're not taking any existing taxes away from anyone, which makes the tool politically attractive. But at the same time, what happens is a developer puts forth a project, says, I want to build X, and in order to build X, there is a but-for test, so the developer has to prove if he doesn't get any incentives, he can't build it. And then having crossed that threshold, then the TIF Commission and subsequently the City Council says, we agree with your project, we want it to happen, and we're willing to divert this amount of taxes away from their intended use and give it to your project to help make it happen.
The idea being that if that project weren't there, those taxes wouldn't have been collected anyway, so that that money now going to that developer or to the owners of that project is not a loss to the city, in theory.
In theory. But you've got to recognize, I don't know, you know, you hear City Hall talk about it. Our school district, we do a five-year projection every year as we put together our budget. And in that projection, we make assumptions about what the growth in revenue is going to be. And so if there is no growth in revenue or limited growth in revenue because of the amount of new taxes that are diverted or abated, if you look at other tools. Mm-hmm. If you look at that, then what you've done is you've stunted the growth.
So we're going to get into some of those arguments for why people believe TIFs should be limited or maybe used much less frequently. How much money are we talking about here if we look at the numbers for Kansas City or even beyond Kansas City?
Well, if you look at the numbers for Kansas City, the city, I don't have a good number for the city.
But the whole metro?
But the whole, I've got, for instance, the Kansas City School District has almost $290 million in assessed valuation that is off the books because of TIF.
And so and how much would
amounts
that have
to about $30 million, $34 million in lost, call it lost revenue, revenue that doesn't arrive.
That would have arrived if these projects were built, but didn't have the TIF financing.
Correct.
But of course, it's hard to measure how much revenue there would be without the projects.
There is nothing more difficult than measuring the negative.
So the idea of this, the but for test, as you put it, was to measure whether the projects would be built. The original concept is that they're built in places that are, quote, blighted, right? Places
That's correct.
That are underdeveloped or undeveloped, and which apparently nobody's interested in.
Well, there are two things that have happened. The first one is the blight definition has been watered down so that almost any place is blighted. I think you've heard arguments that the Plaza is blighted, and the definition of that is economic blight, which means if a building was torn down and a new one was built, it would generate more taxes. And so the definition, so therefore that is blighted. And that kind of a definition. So the blight definition has basically been eliminated in practice. The but-for test, it requires that the developer hire a lawyer, bring him in, and show that their project wouldn't happen if they didn't get the abatement. So they're providing the information that shows why they need it. And
seems like it would be pretty difficult to prove that they're not, that that's not true.
If they have decided that that's the financing strategy they wish to employ, the data tends to support it.
As I said, we're taking two shows to talk about this. Next week, we're going to focus on the arguments for TIF, but today we're focusing on the arguments against tax increment financing, or at least in support of limiting its use. If you are such a critic, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. We'd love to hear your questions or concerns about the use of tax increment financing in the Kansas City Metro. Again, it's 235-2888. I want to ask you, Terry, there was a lot of controversy around one project in particular that got stopped a couple of years ago, and a lot of people would say that was a real turning point in the city's expanding use of TIFs, and that involved the redevelopment of a building in the Crossroads as the new headquarters of the BNIM architectural firm. What happened in that case, just in broad outline?
I would say in broad terms, there's been a rising concern by a number of citizens about the use of TIFs. And so the first question to ask is, do you need it? The original design of the TIF tool was that it would help blight, and that if you could include it in certain projects, then the next project would be able to happen without it. In practice, what happens is the developer comes in and says, you gave it to the guy across the street, why can't you give it to me? And so the effective use of it is not diminished for the second project or the third project or the fourth project. So there were people arguing that the Crossroads had so many projects TIFed.
It's not blighted anymore.
It's no longer blighted, and therefore you don't meet the blight test. It was coming on the heels of two or three other projects where people felt like they'd been run over. Mm-hmm. By the developers and by the decisions of the TIF Commission. And so there was a built-up angst, and the project landed in the crosshairs,
right,
mostly through no fault of their own.
And the Kansas City Public Schools were among those who were raising some serious concerns about it.
Kansas City Public Schools, citizens groups, there were a number. And there was also this underlying concern that why is all of the TIF incentive money, which is really a misnomer, but why is all of that going west of Troost instead of east of Troost?
Well, and that's a question a lot of people have. And is there an answer to that question in your mind? Why is the focus of the TIF funding going to this, to the ever-growing downtown?
Well, I think the reason is because it's not being used as intended. It was intended to be a tool for the city planning department, and it was intended that it would be used for those projects the city was trying to do. But what's happened is it's developer driven, and so it starts from a developer wanting to use this as part of their financing strategy, and developers are choosing not to create projects east of Troost. And when they don't do that, there is no TIF demand, if you will.
And so when you, if that is all true, if developers just aren't interested in developing East of Troost, does that mean we shouldn't be using TIFFs at all? Or should we be offering somehow richer benefits to these developers? I mean, what's the problem with that? Isn't that just how the market works?
Well, that is how the market works. But the issue, really, to me, the issue is not so much that as it is, where are we going with the use of TIFFs? How much of the new revenue should be diverted? And part of the problem with that, too, is that the diversion decision is finally made by the city council. In most cases, for a TIF, it's 100% of the property taxes, which means the schools get nothing, the libraries get nothing, the health department may not get anything. Down the list, there's about a dozen that are dependent on property taxes. The city usually gets their earnings taxes and their sales taxes. So in the worst case scenario, they usually get 50% of the new revenue starting day one. School district may get revenue starting year 23 after the kindergartner's grandchildren have started school.
Where is Kansas City unique in how it uses TIFF? I mean, does St. Louis have a lot of TIFF projects? Are there other parts of the state that have a lot of TIFF projects?
Kansas City is the most aggressive user of the TIFF tool. It's number one. When you start looking at school districts, of the first five school districts in the state impacted by TIFFs, four of them are in the Kansas City area. Kansas City, Liberty, North Kansas City, Park Hill. The only one that slides in there amongst them is St. Louis City.
Which there are some TIFFs used over on the
state. Oh, absolutely. Side. There are TIFFs used in about 75 of the 115 counties in the state of Missouri.
And so that would include some rural areas too then?
Absolutely.
And what are they using them for?
The largest user is Walmart.
Interesting.
And Walmart says, if you want us to build in your city, we want a TIFF.
And so now the developers or the large companies like Walmart are really counting on this.
Counting on it, yes.
816-235-2888, if you want to add your comments, particularly on this week's show, critical comments about the use of TIFF in our area, 235-2888. Let's talk to Travis in Gladstone. Travis, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I live near the Hobby Lobby in Gladstone, and the rumor has been that they are going to be moving a couple of miles south to where the Kmart used to be. That building actually has a lot of repair work to be done. And, Hobby Lobby is going to move down there and do all that repair work because they are getting a tax abatement from the city of Kansas City. In order for Gladstone to attract another business to be able to come in when Hobby Lobby leaves, that would mean that we have to offer another tax abatement, and then it becomes a war of escalation. And really, just for Hobby Lobby to move a couple of miles south, just for Kansas City to take some of that tax revenue, the losers are North Kansas City schools, our public works here in Gladstone and in Kansas City. And that really disturbs me as somebody who, lives here and would like to see our public schools doing well.
Travis, I really appreciate your call. Thanks so much. Let me ask you about that, Terry Ward. You're on the TIFF Commission. You see these proposals. You also represent the North Kansas City School District there. Does Travis have a point?
Yes. He's exactly right. I mean, that's what's happening. And that's part of the biggest dilemma or the biggest challenge that comes from the border war. When there's been great discussions about it.
Usually we're referring to the Missouri-Kansas border.
Missouri-Kansas. In this case, it's Gladstone, Kansas City.
Yeah.
What you've got is a situation where the Depart Ed city loses the tax revenues that were created. If you give away the tax revenues on the receiving city or state, now you've got a reduction in public support. I guarantee they still want the same police protection. They still want the same fire protection. They still want the schools to thrive. But what we've done is created a systemic downward spiral in the public resources to support these critical public activities.
I mean, to push back, a city like Gladstone exists completely within the boundaries of Kansas City.
Correct.
In part, at least, to avoid the tax liabilities that its residents would incur if they lived in Kansas City, right?
Well, yes.
So they're already avoiding taxes.
That's the reason Gladstone was actually originally incorporated back in the 50s.
So it's, you maybe you've taken away with one hand, you have to give with the other.
Well, the net of it is the school district will lose revenues.
And that hurts everybody.
Let's
talk to Bruce in Kansas City, Missouri. Bruce, thanks for calling.
Yes, I want to just comment. I'm a real estate investor, probably own 20 to 25 properties in the metro area. I'm one of these guys that believes in free enterprise. And when I buy a piece of real estate, and I'm not doing any big developing, but when I buy a piece of real estate, I'm not looking for any subsidies. I'm looking to pay, you know, my own way. And when I see what's going on with some of these TIFs and some of the areas that they're granted, it's almost ridiculous. Some of it is the most valuable property in the area, and somehow they're getting a TIF. And what that's doing, that's forcing, and the thing that I think we have to be concerned with the city, we have, you know, a population in the city that's getting older. Their property taxes are going to get to the point where a lot of them are going to have difficult paying their property taxes, even on a moderately priced house. So I think it's gotten totally out of hand.
Bruce, I'm curious, as someone who is concerned that it's gotten out of hand, do you think there's ever a good time or place for using this kind of tax abatement?
Well, my understanding of TIF, and again, I'm going back a long time, but it was when it was originally occurring, it was more, again, in the inner city where maybe development was needed to spur some activity. And I can understand, okay? Mm-hmm. But the corner of North Oak and Vivian Road, where which was probably one of the more valuable pieces of property north of the river, and Terry, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they got a TIF to do the building on that.
You're correct.
Okay, Bruce. Well, I appreciate you calling in. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
I'll ask you the same question, Terry. How do you draw the line? I mean, you don't think all TIFs are bad. You don't think it's always a bad idea. How do you actually distinguish between a good use and a bad use?
Well, I mean, the city put together a matrix to judge that, and it's been marginally effective at best. It comes down to it's a judgment call if you really get to it.
But what are the factors that you would move in that matrix? What would eliminate some of the TIFs that are currently being granted?
Well, I think one of the key factors is job creation. And when I talk about job creation, I mean metropolitan job creation, not just what the earlier caller talked about of an increase in Kansas City and a decrease in Gladstone. So I'd say true job creation. I would say true value. One of the imbalances is out-of-town developers have a larger use of these tools than in-town developers. So we're somehow handicapping against ourselves. That mm-hmm. seems one of the things. One of the interesting things is, you know, the large corporations and developers are the ones who get the tax incentives, and they shift the burden to the small ones. When I started on the school board in North Kansas City, 54% of the taxes were paid by individuals and 46% were paid by businesses of the property taxes. Today, 63% are paid by individuals and 37% are paid by individuals. And there are
by businesses.
By businesses, yeah. Excuse me. Thanks for correcting me. Yeah. So we're in the process of shifting the burden to small business and individuals through our use of TIF.
Let's take another call from Vincent in Waldo. Vincent, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you for having me. Real quick, what is being done to replace or replenish those funds that are lost through TIF, whether it's over the border or even, hey, cities are collecting less taxes from business? What is going to replace those?
So money that is lost to school districts or library districts or even to the county or the city in terms of infrastructure, Vincent's question is what's replacing that?
New taxes. I mean, there is no source. If you take away the growth in because of the increased base and you want to continue to expand the services, if you want teachers to get paid a fair wage, if you want, I mean, look at what we're looking at with sewers and water lines and roads and bridges. All of those diverted taxes are part of what could have paid for those. And so the only place to really replace them is with increased taxes on the businesses that aren't receiving the incentives.
I do want to ask you about a bill that we heard some about earlier in the session in the Missouri House of Representatives, sponsored by local Representative Dan Stacey, that would have redefined blight, that would have required outside study before TIFs were granted. Where does that stand now?
Well, it's gone through the House committees. It hasn't gotten off the floor. We're 2 weeks out. It's the farthest any of the TIF restriction bills have made it. There's also another one being sponsored. That's one of the things. But the more important thing is that it says that school districts could vote not to participate.
Right. Opt out.
And since school districts provide 70% of the revenue, if they opted out, the incentive becomes far less robust, and the school districts aren't the only ones that could opt out. So it creates a situation where it would be nice, but obviously, guess who's opposing it? It would be the Chamber of Commerce and the League of Cities.
Yeah. We should mention we had a response on Twitter from Travis, who reminded us that Gladstone has its own fire, police, city, government, water, etc. We're small and surrounded by Kansas City, but we're our own city, too. And, of course, that's true. There's an infrastructure reduction when TIF money goes away from Gladstone services. Let's take another call. This one's from Kathleen in Olathe. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just a quick comment. I think it would be interesting to change the conversation to really be thinking about what if we didn't do TIF and we used those dollars to attract industry because we had the best trained workforce. We had really addressed issues of poverty. We had addressed issues of early childhood development. We have the best roads. We have the best police. I think it's time to change the conversation and really say, let's make our metro surrounding area one of the best, and so people want to relocate here, as opposed to keep, as several of your callers have said, taking dollars away from those services that make the metro area such a great place to live and would only make it better.
Kathleen, I think that comment speaks for itself, and I appreciate you calling. Thanks.
You bet. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Let's also take one last call. We're almost out of time here, but Mary in Kansas City, just briefly. Thanks for calling up today.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to make sure that people know about an economic study of TIF in Kansas City, Missouri, that UMKC did back in 2007, and it was done by looking at the districts of the city,
uh-huh.
And even though TIF is supposed to help balance, the playing field, where the TIFs went were to the richest of the six districts, and where by far the least TIFs went, both in terms of number of TIFs and certainly in money, was to the third district and the fifth district, and that is, theoretically, in terms of the purpose of TIF, that is where the TIFs should have been going. The name of that study was An Uneven Patchwork.
And you're speaking there of the city ward council districts, right?
Right. Council districts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the third district and the fifth district would be east of Troost, for the most part.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And by far the poorest districts in the city of Kansas City.
Well, Mary, thanks for reminding us of that study. Appreciate you calling in.
Thank you for having this conversation.
Just last very brief question to you, Terry Ward. Where do we go from here? What's the future of TIFs in Kansas City as you see it?
Well, I think there are two things. First of all, the city council needs to show some restraint in their awards. And when I say the city council, that's not only Kansas City. The same could be said of North Kansas City or Liberty or some of the other cities that are, Lee Summit, various cities have various strategies. Some have recognized the balanced comment that came from the lady in Olathe. Some have not. Some want growth at any cost. And so the first choice is a more balanced attitude by those who have the power to grant. The second choice is legislative. And that's what there are the two legislative initiatives this time have gained more support than they have at any point in the past. So I think the dissatisfaction is rising. And so it's going to be a case of either we find a way to work better together or we're going to find a way to take it to the legislature.
That's Terry Ward. He teaches public administration at Park University. He also sits on the city's TIF commission. And he has been bringing us some of the perspectives that call for limiting or making less use of TIFs in the city. We'll cover the other side next week. Terry, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
When we continue, we will meet some of the voices on the other end of the line when someone in crisis calls into the suicide prevention lifeline. How does someone end up doing that incredibly challenging work? And what's it like to sometimes save a life? We'll find out in just a minute. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, we learned about a local lit fest happening this weekend, designed specifically by and for teens and young adults. You can hear my conversation with the organizer and two authors who are taking part at kcur.org/up-to-date. We hope you'll join us tomorrow. You can tune in for a who's who of the trial of Missouri Governor Eric Greitens, learn who the main players are for the prosecution and the defense, and catch up on the legal maneuverings that have already been underway. That's tomorrow on Up to Date. As we've reported on this situation, this station many times before in our talk programs and in our news coverage, local authorities have been concerned over the past many years about an increase in the rate of suicides, particularly among young people. And whenever we talk about that, we always give out the number of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It's a place that anyone can call at any time, night or day, if they're thinking about killing themselves or need to talk to someone about those thoughts and feelings. That number, by the way, is 800-273-8255. But one thing that we mostly haven't done is learn more about the people on the other end of the line when someone makes that call. Who are the voices who, by all accounts, save lives every day? Today we're meeting two of them. Nathan Fredrickson and Jared Otten are both volunteers in the Lawrence offices of Headquarters Counseling Center. That's one of the 150 or so crisis centers around the country that take those calls. And we are honored to have both of you with us today, Nathan and Jared. Welcome.
Thanks, Brian.
Yeah, thank you.
So there was a Columbia University study last year that said, and it said it's very difficult to measure the impact of these calls because of the anonymity and so on. But as best as they're able to tell, 12% of suicidal callers said that talking to someone at Lifeline prevented them from harming or killing themselves. Nathan, have you had that experience?
I've absolutely had that experience. One of the things that we do, especially in our more serious calls, is that we schedule a follow-up just to check in and make sure that everything's okay, make sure they're still safe. And I can speak from personal experience, and I know many of us counselors can, that we've heard directly from the people we've talked to that our intervention helps keep them safe, literally save their lives.
And Jared, does it feel like you are having something to do with keeping people alive in these situations?
Yeah, there's definitely there are moments where you're not sure if the person is safe or not, but there are definitely calls where you have that satisfaction that the person has found some sort of safety.
I want to talk a little more about kind of how this works and how you're able to follow up and so on. But first, I want to talk more about you and who these people are who are answering these calls on the other end of the line. Jared, what do you do when you're not doing this?
I'm actually a social work student, so I graduate, and so it seems like social work and the crisis line has definitely consumed a lot of my life. But outside of that, I like to go kayaking. I like to bird watch. I like to bake pies. So
just a normal guy.
Exactly.
I mean, what motivated you to get involved in this work in the first place?
So when I was 13, I lost my dad to suicide, and that was in 2006. I'm now 25. So at that time, it definitely opened up this big hole in my life, and it's been important for me to feel like I'm doing something to help others not experience the pain of a suicide loss. And it's become so much more than that through volunteering with Headquarters and finding a community of people who are accepting, who are non-judgmental, and feeling like I can do something, you know, being equipped with the skills to help someone in crisis is incredible.
Nathan, what led you to seek out this opportunity to volunteer?
Well, I had a similar experience two summers ago. My cousin killed himself. And in fact, I learned the day of my orientation for my master's in social work program. And that was really framed my experience beginning trying to work in any kind of mental health care. And I learned about headquarters at nearly the same time that our whole family was going through that tragedy. And I knew that that's where I had to be.
You know, I'm curious. You both are social work students. You also both experienced the loss of suicide of someone close to you. Is that common for the people who are among you taking these calls?
It's very common. In fact, we were having that discussion on our way here about the vast majority of the counselors, volunteer counselors, have been impacted in some way by suicide, either directly or indirectly.
And does that have an impact on the work you do? Does that actually help you, do you think, connect with the people who are calling in?
Yeah, I certainly think it helps you empathize with the folks who are calling in. At a certain point, you begin to move past some of your own experiences and being able to empathize with a variety of experiences, but always kind of operating from that common experience of loss or of pain. So
I imagine it must be hard for it not to become too personal. I mean, to process your own emotions about your own life and your own loss in the context of the people who are calling.
Yeah, and that is one of the beauties of headquarters and the call room, which is actually a special place.
Tell me about it. Describe the call room at headquarters.
So it's pretty small. We were talking about it earlier. It's kind of dingy. But it's still a wonderful place. There's a wall of snacks. Sometimes it has an odor, but that's okay. And usually you're on a shift with another person, and you just have the opportunity to have some of the deepest conversations that you've ever had with your shift partner, the opportunity to process a difficult call. And we rely heavily on that support of each other to be able to do the difficult job that we do.
There's usually just two of you in the room at the time?
Two is the most common amount, yeah. And I'll say that in my experience, without the support of that other person, it can be really hard to emotionally process some of the mm-hmm. difficult work that we do. So it's really important, I think, to have that kind of solidarity.
Do you just take turns answering calls as they come in? Is that how it works?
Yep. Yeah.
So it's random, essentially, who you end up talking with.
Yep. Yeah, we try to stick to the one and then the other. That way no one's getting too overworked.
How long is a shift?
The average shift is 4 hours, but there are overnight shifts as well.
That shift is from 8 p.m. to, midnight to 8 a.m.
Which seems like a long time to be dealing with something of such intensity as this.
Yeah, definitely. And working through the night is a challenge, and we have some dedicated staff who are able to fill that time slot. But that's definitely a challenge to fill in terms of having a volunteer available.
How involved are other people when you are actually on a call yourself? Obviously, if they're in the room, they can hear what you're saying. But are they listening in on the line? Are they just there to support you after the call?
They don't listen in on the line, but often, especially because many calls tend to take similar paths. Often someone listening carefully can have a good sense of what's going on. And I know personally, if it sounds like my partner has had a really difficult call, I always make a point of asking them how it went, asking if they want to decompress.
It's like you're caring for the people on the calls, but you're also caring for each other.
Exactly.
I'm curious how you get trained to do this. This isn't mm-hmm. something that I would assume everybody... it may not come naturally to anybody. It certainly doesn't come naturally to everybody. How do they train you to do this, Jared?
So the skills are definitely transferable. And I think, you know, one thing I learned by going through training was that I'm gaining something that anyone can really gain, and that's listening skills. So that's a core of it. In addition to that, we have about 100 hours of more classroom kind of training. And then outside of that, we're spending a lot of time on observation shifts, and we're also doing a lot of role plays. So that involves experienced volunteer counselors providing a role play or scenario that then the trainee would be the counselor.
And this all happens before you take your first call?
Yeah. Yeah.
So 100 hours of training.
Yeah.
Mm. That's pretty intense. Mm. Are there people who start that training and sort of find, you know, this really isn't for me. This isn't what I should be doing.
Yeah, that I think that's a relatively common experience. In fact, I know in my training group, someone was really excited to be a part of the training process and to be a volunteer counselor, but tragically, one of his close friends died by suicide during the training period, and it was just too close mm-hmm. emotionally, too raw, and he had to leave. And of course, we were all very understanding of that. And I don't think that's the first time that something like that's happened either.
You know, I'm curious if either of you has found the training to have had an impact beyond just your work at the call center. Do you feel like, I mean, you're both studying social work. Has it affected the way you're going to practice whatever particular vocational path you end up in, Nathan?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I found most surprising in my calls is that so many of these calls, you know, when we think about suicide, we often only think about the individual. And of course, you know, there are individual problems that everyone who calls suffers through. But something that I've learned is that so often their struggles are related to broader social questions. A lot of callers have considered suicide because they're broke and they feel that they can't provide for their family. I've had callers who were afraid that they were going to be deported. I've had callers who were suffering some kind of debilitating medical condition and didn't feel like they could get the care that they needed, could afford the care that they needed. And in those cases, they thought that the way out of their pain was through suicide.
And I know you can't replicate exactly how those calls went, but those are great examples of problems that are real problems that you can't do anything about, an immigration crisis or an employment situation. So what kind of support do you offer when that call comes in? What do you say to the person when they tell you a problem and, you know, your first reaction is, yeah, that is a problem?
Yeah, well, to what you just said is a huge part of it, to acknowledge that this is a problem, to acknowledge that we hear them, that we hear that their pain is there and that it's real and that, you know, they aren't just crazy, that it is something that's very significant. And that alone works wonders. But from there on, our number one goal is to, the phrase we use is safer now, and connect someone to safety, however that might be.
And by safety, you mean what?
Essentially, it means disarming whatever plan they might have for suicide and connecting them to either individuals or institutions that can be with them and ensure that they are in a place where they can keep themselves safe.
Jared, I know you can't get into incredibly specific details about particular calls that could identify mm-hmm. someone, but give me an example of a call that that you would say has stuck with you.
One call that comes to mind, it comes to mind because it was a 3-hour call, which is a pretty long time to be on the phone.
That's longer than usual.
Yes. Yeah. But I remember the gentleman lived in a rural community in western Kansas, and we had a conversation. He was recently, he got out of jail, and he was at the point that he was thinking about suicide. So we came up with a plan together to keep him safe for now. And that plan meant walking to the hospital because he didn't have transportation. So that, hence why the conversation was 3 hours. But during that time, we were able to build a relationship, as much of a relationship as you can build in that amount of time over the phone, and talked about all sorts of things. Ultimately, he got to the hospital. It was his decision, which was really important. And I had the closure that, all right, this person is safe for the time being, and that's all that you can ask for when your role is to just be on the phone with them.
And you stayed on the phone with him through his whole walk to the hospital.
Yeah, it was exhausting, but you know, the experience of being present and listening, you know, it's a gift. It's really a gift to be there and walking with folks as they get the help that they need.
Literally walking with
literally
them
walking. Yeah.
Yeah. Nathan, is there a call that stands out to you?
Well, probably the calls that I find the most memorable are the calls that have to do with those kind of social problems that we as individuals on the phone feel powerless in some respect to help with. So those ones always stick with me because they're painful for that reason. But I think the individual call that I remember most clearly is one where I definitely was able to provide help. And this is one of those calls where I was fortunate enough to check in with them later. And this individual was a teenager who was strongly considering suicide, had a plan, and it was one of my early calls too. So I went by the book, helped this young person to safety, and then when I checked in with this person the following day and heard firsthand how what our conversation did for this teenager. Literally said, "You saved my life," and that's one of the most powerful moments in my life, and I'll always remember that.
It's powerful just to hear you talk about him. How many of the calls you get are people who are sort of right on the brink, who are actually in that moment considering suicide, and how many are versus the number who are, you know, this is something I've started to think about. I just need some resources, or even I just need someone to talk to. Jerry,
I can't speak to the exact number at this time, but. You're right that it's a spectrum of questions, and it's not always someone who's at the brink of crisis.
Not every call is a crisis.
Exactly. And the conversations with folks who maybe have recently experienced a loss and have questions about coping with that loss, we also get those types of calls. And we also get calls from folks who are concerned about someone close to them. And so that's an opportunity to provide them with helpful language and resources for connecting their loved one with either a community resource or the Lifeline.
And all of those calls are appropriate, right?
Exactly.
We should give the number again, by the way, while we're thinking about it. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number is 800-273-8255. That's 273-TALK, if you have the letters on your phone. Nathan, you guys do this in Lawrence, right?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
There's call centers all over the country. Are the calls that are routed to you local? I mean, do they do this geographically?
Yeah. Anyone with a Kansas area code is going to be routed through us, although I believe there is also a call center in Wichita. But we also have a local number for headquarters that we give out for people who need the kind of counseling service we provide, but are perhaps not in imminent crisis, mm-hmm. or maybe they are members of the Lawrence community, and it's good to hear from a fellow Lawrencean.
Well, and you mentioned counseling. Obviously, that's probably a good idea for a lot of the people who call you. They may or may not have chosen to do that, or even after the call choose to do that. But how do you try to escalate or encourage people to seek professional help that goes beyond what you can do in a phone call?
Well, one thing that we try to do is try and build a consensus with the caller about what they feel capable of doing in order to work towards their safety, both in the short term and in the long term, if possible. And so often we'll be frank and say something to the effect of, you know, it sounds like you could really benefit from some long-term care. And if people are find that acceptable, then we'll work with them to look for, say, community mental health centers in their area and encourage them to get connected to that kind of care.
And do you actually get their phone number, get contact information so you can follow up with them?
Ultimately, that's up to them. So if they're willing to provide us with their phone number and then they consent to a follow-up, then we can check in with them. It's not always going to be the same counselor, but it's going to be someone who's there to listen and follow through with the plan that they've created with another counselor. So it's important for us to empower them to follow through with that.
You know, I want to be sensitive in how I ask this. We've been talking about memorable calls that ended well. Obviously, not every call ends well. How do you deal with that as people who have emotions and who have yeah. who have feelings and who have experienced loss, Jared?
It goes back to having the support of other counselors and the volunteers at headquarters, and that community that we have is what reminds us that we know we're taking these calls, and the moment the phone rings, you don't know what the outcome of that call will be. So we remind each other of that, and then we make sure that we encourage each other to support each other and to do the things that we love, whether it's kayaking or baking pies. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Nathan?
Yeah. Yeah. That's my thoughts exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I would think it would be hard not to know how it turns out. I mean, to when maybe you don't get that opportunity to follow up. Do you find yourself thinking a lot about these calls afterward, or are you able to sort of hang up the phone and do a mental cleanse and not be consumed by it?
Yeah, sometimes it is really hard to let it go. And we all, it's an important part of our culture to understand that, you know, we have to leave these calls behind at a certain point. But that is easier said than done. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it takes a little extra effort. But I find, you know, as we've both mentioned, that the best way through that is to talk with one of the counselors who knows exactly what that feeling is like.
You know, I think there might be people listening who think, you know, this is something that I maybe mm-hmm. should consider doing, volunteering in this way. Are there certain, I don't know, personal qualities that you think are necessary for this work? If you should be asking yourself whether it's the right thing for you, what are the qualities needed to do this, Jared?
Well, it's important for counselors to be empathetic and non-judgmental, because we never know what the person on the other end of the call is experiencing. So that's definitely something that is a foundational quality. The skills, though, like I mentioned earlier, are transferable to a lot of folks. So improving how you listen and how you communicate directly, assertiveness, you know, there are a lot of basic communication skills, and then also specific skills related to safety planning and just being comfortable talking about suicide, because that's something that we're often not comfortable doing.
Yeah, that's not a small thing. A lot of people just really aren't comfortable talking about it. Nathan, are there any qualities you would add to that list?
Well, one thing I've noticed, just a general pattern of the volunteer counselors there, is that every volunteer I've ever talked to is just incredibly kind. I think you have to be a kind person in order to be able to have that kind of very serious empathy.
If someone does think this might be something they could do, or that at least they want to explore, or then maybe consider the training, what should they do? Where should they call?
They should call 785-841-2345.
And we'll get that number and put it on our website so we can share that. But that's Headquarters Counseling Center.
That's right. Yeah, that's the local number. And they can also go to headquarterscounselingcenter.org. We'll have another training group this summer. We have three training groups a year generally. And the information sessions are this week in Lawrence.
Well, I wish we had more time to talk about this, but this has been incredibly significant and meaningful. Jared Otten and Nathan Fredrickson, two counselors, volunteers who take calls at the Headquarters Counseling Center when people call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
And again, the number, if you are thinking about suicide, it's free and confidential and open all the time, day or night. It's 800-273-8255. Yesterday on the program, we talked about 10 women writers who influenced our culture in the 20th century. You can hear that conversation and other previous episodes at kcur.org/uptodate. Don't forget, you can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. I'm at @ptsbrian. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook, too. Tomorrow's Up to Date, Kansas City bids farewell this weekend to Cypress Avenue. We'll sit down with musical host Bill Shapiro to discuss his 40 years on the airwaves. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.